Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the First Gen Collective. This is episode 7. Can you believe it? I can't believe it. I know I say every episode is special, but that's because they truly are. These stories are incredible, and they are the legacies of these wonderful humans. Today, I have my little brother from another mother, Christopher Dora. We grew up together on the same block in Queens, New York for a few years before he departed to Miami with his family. Then he went to Haiti to live for a few years, and then he came back to Miami again. His mother was a second mother to me. I was fully integrated from about age 4 to about age 7 into their beautiful Haitian family, eating the amazing food, and at some point even understanding Creole French when she used to call out for me and speak to me. Chris is an amazing soul. He's here to share his story and adversity on his dream of joining the NFL and how that dream almost cost him his life. But his resilience and appetite for life and his family is infectious. He's a First Gen success story. Remember to follow me on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, and follow me on Instagram by looking up the First Gen Collective. Take it away, Chris. All right. We are recording, Christopher. So hi, everyone. If you can see the screen, but you can't because this is a podcast, so it's audio, you can see my handsome, smiling, amazing, wonderful brother, Christopher Dora. And Christopher Dora is not biologically my brother, but he is like my brother. This is a really special episode for me because it kind of comes full circle for me to be able to interview someone that is from my childhood, someone that's from Queens. So this is truly a special deluxe episode. and so why is Christopher on the First Gen Collective today? What is the First Gen Collective? Christopher is here today because he's part of the First Gen Collective. He is part of that collection of voices, of stories, of people that grew up in United States who share this common scenario of being a first gen in the United States, figuring your shit out on your own, right? Like just figuring it out, not having any blueprint in front of you, parents coming over from other countries. So for in Christopher's situation, Christopher's Haitian, first generation Haitian American. And to connect the dots here, Christopher and I go back. We grew up on the same block in Queens, New York. Yep. And the reason we met is because we were literally living next door, and you know, my mom was going through a very painful divorce, and childcare ain't cheap. And my mom and your mom, who was, you know, you and your dad, immigrants from Haiti, moved to Queens, make a life for yourself. Your mom, like really, really, when my mom was going through one of the most difficult times and periods in her life, was really there for us, like family. Like she was like, Lily, you go do what you have to do. You go work. I know you have to put food on the table, pay the bills, pay the rent. Like I will take care of Vanessa. And so I was just like a part, I was like the fourth child in your family for a while. Like,
love you, sis.
Yeah. I mean, growing up and I mean, we got into some good trouble in Queens, running around in those blocks. And it was so diverse. Like, I mean, we're talking about across from us were like kids and families from Afghanistan, and the other side they were from Colombia, and then the other side they were Mexican. It was, and upstairs for me they were Indian. I mean diversity at its best in our little complex in Queens. But truly, like, your mom, you know, took me into her family, was there for us at one of the most critical times in my mom's life. She pretty much only spoke to me in Creole, and if you know, Creole is the French that is spoken in Haiti. So I think I was pretty much understanding Creole French by the time you guys had moved over. But that is my introduction to Christopher Dora. And it is honestly an honor to have you here today with us.
Thank you so much, sister. You know, when you think about history, I think it's really in itself a blessing. We were raised in New York, Queens, Flushing. I think that just, it never leaves my mind to think that people can, you know, have so many different life journeys, you know, a part of your overall, you know, experiences that help really kind of, you know, make you who you are today. And, you know, living in Queens was cold. It was definitely different, but I was born there. And when I think about it as a young child, I've always been kind of the kid that stood out. And, you know, I was always the tallest one in my classroom, but I always knew that, you know, I had to become something because obviously my parents did so much and they sacrificed everything they had to provide a lifestyle for their children. When they left that country, you know, 40 plus years ago, they decided to come back and really, you know, provide an opportunity for us because they knew that it was very limited in a third world country of Haiti. But, you know, we learned so much in the American system. I think that, you know, when we would go to school, I would be honored. I'd be happy to be around other types of kids that, you know, spoke different languages, that, you know, looked different from me. And I remember days that we would walk over to school. Growing up in New York was a special place because, you know, we all reunited as children and we used to play. We used to have snowball fights. We used to run around the block. You know, just, you know, hang out all the time and just have fun. We went to the zoos together, you, my sisters, my mom, you know, we had great moments. And I think those are the moments that you'll never forget about. And I think today you think about when you see those pictures, how much joy that we had. It was a struggle, but it was a good struggle because obviously we didn't have everything on.
We had so little, but we were so happy.
And that's really where I feel like I want to be able to provide that same lifestyle to my children one day and my family, because I feel that because we did grow up in that, you know, scenario. And I think it taught us so much about who we are today, to be humble, to be able to appreciate, you know, and not take things for granted. When you look at how things are today, you know, in the United States, there's so much opportunity. And, you know, we have so much, you know, diversity, culture, and we welcome that with open arms. I can't say for everybody or for every situation, but I think you learn so much, you know, how migrants are able to really together build a strong unit. And it doesn't matter if it's in your work world, if it's in your personal world, but together as, you know, people, I'm a people person. I love people. I think really that's kind of my driver every single morning. What, you know, allowed me to know that there's so much more in society when you really get to know a person, you know, their stories, and really looking at ways that you can learn from. You know, I learned a lot from you. You were older than me. You were in my sister's, you know, age group. And I think, you know, by me having women that I looked up to allowed me to be the gentle man that I am today. And to be able to treat women fair and to, you know, love a different species, a different sex that's not like me, but at the same time is like me. Because when you think about what we went through, the challenges, you know, I would go to you guys for advice. And I think that was really what allowed me to, you know, become the man that I am today. Now, when we left New York and, you know, had the ability to, you know, leave because of the conditions of how cold it was for us. We came to my
conditions are like, this is cold. This is an island.
It was different for us. And I feel that, you know, having the experience in New York, like you create kind of that strength. Because when we came to Miami was a whole different place for us. It was tropical, it was warm, the climate. I remember you coming to visit us, you know, a few times, and it was just amazing. We'd be able to go to the pool.
Yeah, I was just, because I think at that point I was still living in Manhattan. We had moved from Queens to Manhattan, and I thought Miami was like magical. Like I was like, oh my God, like there's a pool. And I remember you guys lived in that complex where it was just like, it was so beautiful. And I was telling my parents, like, what are we doing here? Like, we need to get down there. What are we doing here? Yeah, I remember that. I remember coming to visit you guys.
We always wish you guys would move closer to us, but I think it was just kind of, you know, us staying connected and together really what allowed us to know that it was glue, it was family. And that's really what was important, because even look today, like we're talking about 30 years into the future and we're still glue, we're still family.
Absolutely.
And you know, in my journey, I went through so many different things that I'm going to share today, but really just share with the audience that, you know, when you have family, sometimes it's overall family that keeps you going. And that's really what's important today, is that we always have each other no matter what part of the globe we're at.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a good segue into telling us a little bit about Christopher Dora's story, right? Because I know that, you know, you are a first gen success story, but I want you to share with other people, what is your first gen success story? There's some adversity in there. I know things probably got tough and you persevered, and now you know, you join us here in your beautiful suit. And I want people to hear about, you know, your successes, but also the adversity and like how hard it is to not have a roadmap when you're first gen and you're just figuring it out. You know, our parents are working class, blue collar. We didn't have folks to tap when we were like, hey, we're going to go to college. Like, what do we do now? We didn't have that disposable to us, accessible, and we really like created this. And this is not to downplay all the sacrifices that our parents made for us, because they literally gave us everything that they could for us to then get to the next level. But it's also a very different experience not having generations of people behind you in this country like paving a way, right?
Absolutely.
So walk us through your story, and you know, from the time you got to Miami and like what was happening next, how are you navigating new school in Miami, kid from Queens, New York, like next step, and then where you are today.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, when we left New York, it was different because we weren't ready for that whole different Miami lifestyle, which was tropical. We left New York and I was like 7 years old. And, you know, I always remember when we moved into our brand new house in Miami, we were kind of like in the new construction phase in the neighborhood. So there weren't many neighbors that we had, but my parents knew that we had to find good schools, and they knew that they had to, you know, really make sure that we were, you know, building a strong foundation and continuing from where we started. When I started, you know, elementary school, you know, it was scary. Because obviously I didn't know how to adapt to a new setting, but I really learned that, you know, pushing myself and being able to, you know, go to class, you know, learn, you know, kids' names and understand that, well, when I go home and have homework, who's going to help me? My mom. And obviously she was the one that, you know, didn't speak the language, was, you know, at home, you know, working, you know, with us, the children, when my dad was working and, you know, allowing us to have a lifestyle. And, you know, my parents are hard workers. Obviously, when you think about, you know, what they've instilled in us today, you know, that's really kind of my backbone of how I, you know, am as a professional and, you know, where I look at when I still have, you know, challenges. You know, we did a couple of years in Miami and decided that Miami was good, but my parents still had, you know, the interest for us to learn our country. And that was when we decided that, you know, Miami was a great place for us, but we want to, you know, expose the kids to Haiti. We want them to understand that lifestyle, understand that third world country. So what we did is we picked up and left, and we moved to Haiti for a few years. And I'll tell you, that was even more of exposure that we weren't used to. Having McDonald's, having running water, lights, you know, being able to know that you can just drive down the street, go pick up a pizza and be okay, not have to, you know, look over your shoulder, because right. You just didn't know the security and the impact of, you know, the situation at the time. But because my parents, you know, knew that was their backyard, that's where they're from, their culture, they wanted to expose us to that. And it showed me so much, Vanessa, in regards to, you know, different lifestyles, because when you are now in a country, an island, and everybody knows everybody, they know if you're not necessarily, you know, living in that country for many, many years, and you're kind of the fresh person, fresh face on the block. My sisters and I attended a Christian academy, an American school, but we still had to kind of, you know, self-teach ourselves. And, you know, those were, you know, the days where, finding an organization to join, like basketball, brotherhood, friends, and really creating that overall lifestyle was tough because I was used to, getting on my red bicycle in New York that I brought to Florida and just cruising. It wasn't the same atmosphere in Hayden. And, there were times where, when I would be, we were driving to school, you would see dead bodies on the floor. And you're like, well, what is going on here? It's not like in the U.S. that they cover these things up. When we were driving to school and at a very young age, I'm seeing this. I'm seeing what's going on in this country. But I'm like, whoa, this is where I'm living. It's a jungle. But it's such a beautiful place. It's so rich in resource. It's so much things in that country. But when you think about the injustice, even in that country, they were in debt for 122 years to France. And then the U.S. also took a big, advantage of, that country and that island is the reason why they're in that position today. But when we were growing up in Haiti, we realized that we had to stay focused and grounded. And it came to a point where my mother, she was like, well, you know what? The kids are American, but at the same time, they know enough about this country after 2.5 to 3 years. It's time for them to go back to the U.S. and get an opportunity. My mom made that decision and told my father that this is not going to work out for the kids to grow up here further into their lives because, one, we want to make sure that they have an opportunity. And she took that strong decision and said, we're moving back. After that experience, I was close to my family, my grandma, my cousins, and I realized that, there's so much love here. There's so much enrichment. But you know what? For us, there was limited future. And in the sense of us having to, be able to kind of, pick up from where we left off and kind of restart the clock. It was a great experience. We had great laughs. We had great birthdays. We were in an amazing home that we still own today. Lots of land. I had Dalmatians. I had little, country dogs. Like those were kind of like my friends. And I felt like, I had that bond with animals that I love so much. And, I always think about Blackie, my little dog that I named the Dalmatian Lucky. Every Saturday, I would watch these animals and just care for them like they were my own children. But I knew for a fact that because mom saw that there was so much opportunity for us to, further our life, we left Haiti. And we came back to the States and we hit the ground running. That's when I was actually in junior high. Now, come to find out, Vanessa, when you're in a different country and you're not keeping up with kind of what's going on the TV in the USA, you come back and you're a whole different person. You're like, well, I gotta catch up.
I mean, especially those like years that are really like shaping you, right? Like those teenage years where, that's like, if you think about it, those are the years that are really, really molding you. I mean, I think each decade is very important and you learn different things, but really like during your teenage years, like you're absorbing everything around your environment, right?
Absolutely. And, I had to, rely on sports to kind of get myself back into some type of program. When we came back, into the U.S., I started junior high, eighth grade in Miami. And it was, it was a school where I wasn't accepted. I wasn't accepted because, one, I spoke a different language. The kids that I went to school with, they would always, bully me, if you tell you the truth. And I wasn't prepared for that. Because obviously I had to face a community that I wasn't aware of, and there was still adversity, but because of the way that I was raised to make sure that even if you go through challenge, you're not backing down and you're not going to at some point, face a challenge and fold. If you get challenged, you have to put both feet on the ground and charge right back because that's life. That's the pressure that we all face every single day that we wake up and have to go through adversity, racism, being belittled because we're not, people that, look like, the norm, the normalcy is what they say. But when you think about where I started finding resilience is when I knew that I trusted in God. And I knew God had a plan for me, and I knew that my family was my backbone. We connected many times over the years and connected, with your family, our family, and we just always stayed bonded, which was amazing because we knew that you guys were our real family no matter what. Even if you guys were still states away, When I decided that, you know, turning the page after junior high and getting into high school was when I started developing, I started becoming more of, you know, more confident in my own skin. And, you know, I started, you know, getting into more weight training. I, you know, decided that football was going to be an option for me to join. And believe it or not, I did 1 year high school football and I got a scholarship. That let me know in itself that, you know, God is true. And by praying and being consistent was really when the opportunities opened up for me. I took my scholarship and hit the ground running and attended the University of Charleston in West Virginia. Coal mine state, girl. When I say, you know, way different from Haiti, the tropical weather in Florida, and then now going, you know, 18 years old to a state where, you know, you weren't heavily accepted. You know,
no, not a lot of people that look like you or me.
Right, right. And I learned so much just being there because I decided to put my head down. I got paid to play. I got paid to be an athlete in college. And when I realized that that was a stepping stone for me, I knew for a fact that I was going to focus on my education because my mom always said, you know what? In life, they can take away all the physical, but they can never take away what's in your mind. And that was really what resonated with me and allowed me to pursue business. And I focused on business and I actually graduated in 3 years, believe it or not. I did about 22 credit hours a semester. I had a job. I was so focused because you had nothing to do. I mean, you know, you leave.
What are you going to do in West Virginia?
Right. You leave tropical weather where you can go to parties, have fun at 16. But then when you go to a university that's so small, we had 1,200 kids. At the university. I think that's 1,000 kids in my high school. So to tell you the truth, how focused I was, I got stuff done. And I knew for a fact that I had to put my, you know, head down, bring my lunch pail to work and just grind. Now, you know, after I completed my bachelor's of science, I pursued a master's degree and I did achieve that. And that was an amazing experience in itself because that was really when I realized that the real world is really what you're going to experience when they're going to say, hey, figure this out and run with it and come back with a formula. And that was a challenge that allowed me to really put myself in a position where being able to achieve a master's in business administration and leadership, you know, really set the stage for me. And when I realized that I had that education, it was two options that I had after I finished that master's degree. I could have went right into the private sector, start an internship, or the NFL came knocking. And that was when I decided that sports was kind of, you know, going to be the next life for me. You only get one shot at going pro. And believe it or not, I decided, well, if I had the master's at this point in my life, there's no turning back. If it doesn't work out, then I'll, you know, go into business in some capacity. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but yeah. I said, you know what, at least I have an education. And that's when the pro-life, you know, the light shed. And I decided to take that leap of faith and you know, go try out and walk onto the Miami Dolphins. I had the master's degree, but I knew for a fact if I went and pursued my dream and had the ambition and was optimistic about it, good things can happen. 12 and a half years ago is when I decided to, you know, walk on to the Miami Dolphins, and things were amazing. I had a great opportunity. You know, Tony Sperano was my head coach before God, you know. And so unfortunately, he's no longer with us, but, you know, Chad Henne was our quarterback. It was a great cast of players in the locker room. But, you know, when you fast forward a little bit under 3 years, you know, I had great experiences playing in different leagues. But when I got hurt in Pittsburgh, I faced severe trauma. And that trauma is really what allowed me to, you know, take a different turn. I dehydrated severely, and it was in Pittsburgh where I had no idea what was going on. And all I remember was collapsing.
What were you doing out in Pittsburgh?
Well, I was actually, you know, with the Steelers at the time. And, you know, at that point in my life, I was still playing to, you know, continue to compete during training camp. And obviously one thing led to another where I dehydrated. I didn't have enough bodily water in my body, and I was pushing myself to the capacity. When you're in the pro sports realm, everybody's good. Everybody knows how to play their position. So you have to compete. And at times you don't think about slowing down because it's like, well, the strongest, the fastest, the biggest person that delivers on that play is who gets noticed. So I was pushing myself to a capacity where my body couldn't take it anymore and shut down. And one thing led to another where I blacked out, collapsed, and all I can remember is being picked up and placed into an ambulance and rushed over to the UPMC hospital. And when I got there, the physicians diagnosed me with a blood clot, because they said, well, here's the thing, you dehydrated so bad that you got a blood clot and it's more serious than we think. Mind you, I didn't have anybody with me. I was by myself. I had 16 physicians surrounding me. One, because I was a football player, so they really were like, kind of like, well, what's going on here? Yeah. On a stretcher bed, they're saying, well, here's the thing. If we don't make a decision in a small window, Christopher, it's either we're going to have to cut your leg off and amputate it, because there wasn't enough circulation of blood, you know, going through your leg and body, or we try to operate and fix this thing. Now, obviously, hearing something like that at 22 was not the best moment. And I said, you know, I'm going to pray to God and say, you know what? All I can think about was my family, my parents, my siblings. And I said, you know what, if this is the time for me, then at least I had the best life I could live, but I'm not giving up. And it goes back to my parents, my family, what they instilled in me at a young age. And I said, you know, I'm a fighter and I'm going to go into surgery because I'm not going back to Miami with one leg. We went into surgery, and as they were performing the incisions, my heart stopped.
Oh my God. And I
still get a little emotional about having to relive that testimony every time I share the story, because I got a second chance at life. And I'm so blessed in so many ways that I realized my true values, because God said it wasn't your time yet.
Absolutely.
When I woke up that next morning, they literally told me that they had to revive me with the two square pegs, the shockers that they place on your heart. And they revived me. And when I woke up, I realized that my family was there, my parents, my sisters. And that's when I realized that I couldn't do this anymore. And I broke down, and I went into tears, and I realized that life is not about, you know, a business. It's about your values. And my values are my family. And I spent 3 months there and, you know, had the ability to, you know, continue rebuilding myself. And you actually came to visit me, Vanessa, with your mom and your dad.
Mom and my dad. And I think my brother may have come too.
Yeah.
I mean, we came to visit because it, you know, your mom and my mom, perhaps through a phone call or a text, someone got the message that it was bad. It was real bad. And we were like, we need to go and be there for them. And, you know, we got in the car from, at that point, now we lived in New Jersey, and we got in the car, and I think it was like 6 or 7 hours from New Jersey. So we got in the car and we got to Pittsburgh, and we came and we saw you and we saw your parents. I remember we took your mom and your dad out for a meal because I think they had been in the hospital for so many days. So it was nice for them to just go and have, you know, sit down in a restaurant and get a meal. But we got the message. It was bad is what translated. And so we got up there. We wanted to see you. We wanted to make sure you were okay. So, you know, it was rough. I remember going into the room and seeing you. And with the one thing I can't forget this, is your spirit and your energies was 100%, 100. Like, you were just like, I'm good. I survived this. Like, I'm here. And I was like, wow, like, incredible, incredible. Because your recovery after that wasn't easy. And I remember like where they had to perform the surgery, was a part that it looked like it needed a lot of healing after that. And a lot of work had to be done to make sure that you were going to be back on the right path to recovery, right? Like that could not have been easy.
And thank you so much for, you know, you guys just, you know, showing up and being there in our support. And it just goes back to just being family. Like, we grew up together at an early stage in our life. And look at that, you know, fast forward into, you know, where we ended up in the middle of our lives. You know, you and your family showed up for us. You've always been there. I'm so grateful that you're my sister. And, you know, at the end of the day, it made me inspired because you, your family, my family, us, we were there and you guys were a part of that. And that was inspiring because I spent 3 months hospitalized.
Yeah.
I went in at 350-pound offensive lineman, and then I got rolled out on a wheelchair at 280 pounds, like LeBron wow. James skinny, refrigerated to LeBron James skinny. So it was a big, big difference, and I couldn't stay anymore in that hospital because even in that hospital, I didn't have a great experience. And when I finally left, I decided that I got to get back to Miami. And in rehab alone, I had to, you know, learn how to walk again. And that's when I realized that, you know, things have to change and I have to, you know, kind of get out on my feet. But the discipline that I had, the work ethic is really what got me a speedy recovery. And when I became strong enough, I said, you know what, I'm never going back into a relapse. I am going to focus on my master's degree and then get into business. And, you know, 7 years down the road, here I am wearing nice suits and helping people. And, you know, that's an amazing, amazing accomplishment that I have and can say that, you know what, life always throws you curveballs, but you can't quit because you know why? The way that we were brought up. Immigrants who decided to take a risk and say, you know what, we're going to pave the way for our family. If my parents never took that risk, I would not be where I am today. And that's why I'm grateful. That's why I know that I got to keep fighting for my people.
Absolutely. And if my parents didn't take the risk and come over from this small little country in Central America, Honduras, and come here and land in Queens and meet the Doras, I mean, I don't know what my story would be like.
Which I can't wait to visit Honduras, you know, one day.
I know. It's so funny that you talk about this, that your parents have this, like, sort of, like, they have this true connection to Haiti, right? My parents have this connection to Honduras. Like, they want us to see it through their eyes. And they want us to experience it through their eyes. My parents also built a home in Honduras that they go to once a year. And my dad is so proud of it. And but they really want it to be like in my DNA. Like I understand the culture, the people, the humility, the like the poverty. Like they want you to see that and to know it. And they want you to like take that. And that can be your drive, right? Like that. That's what's going to get you to the next thing, the next step. And I love that your parents have that connection to Haiti too, because it's really true. Like when you have parents who are immigrants, you are experiencing them living here, but with their mind there. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So they share that in common, my parents and you.
That's why we get along so well, because we have so much commonalities that, you know, it doesn't matter where you're from in this world, as long as you can see that, you know, your upbringing, your family, your culture, there's so much of a melting pot in this world. This is why America is great and America is the way it is, because we are able to accept all and allow each other to lift each other up through our education, through our religion, to what our belief system is. But we get that from our families, our parents, of their culture that instilled that in us. So I'm excited. And I think obviously there's so much more room for growth ahead. And I can't wait to go to Honduras, by the way.
All right. I mean, if my mom and dad hear this, which they will be texting you. So you'll be on the next flight whenever they just got back from there about a month ago. But okay, so now it's, you know, post football sort of devastating injury that really shook you and sort of jolted you. Where did it take you to now? Like, what are you doing now? Cool.
Great question.
What you doing?
You know, I love what I do. I help people. And I became a financial advisor. Been doing this now for about 6 years. And really I have a focus helping people and all types of people. When I say people, helping charities, being a part of the NFL Players Association, get involved a lot with kids. I think it's such an impact that I'm able to help because I have a personal connection, because I got a second chance at life. And I know how humble I am to be able to have the brain power to be able to understand what I understand in my financial world, to not only help and service people in the community with what I do as a financial advisor, but at the same time, use that strategic mindset to help people in charitable organizations, nonprofits. I take such an interest, and I guess I'm giving you a sneak peek, but I got a book coming out. It's a little bit of a collaboration of my story and charities of how they can be sustainable, and be able to kind of overcome turbulent times like we just faced the pandemic we're still in today. So as a financial advisor, I help organizations, I help charities. And I help businesses, also for-profit corporations, really help them with, how do they understand how to have a succession plan and learn how to, either exit their business and transfer it to their children, their generation to come, or really prepare themselves for a retirement. So I'm a strategic financial advisor. And I love what I do because I'm always pushing myself. I still wake up every single morning at 4:30. And I'm studying more certifications. I'm pushing myself because I know knowledge is power. And I really, really want to pay it forward by, helping others like ourselves, kids who didn't have the opportunities. I didn't wake up with a gold spoon in my mouth. I didn't have, my uncle who worked at a top firm that, made the introduction. I had Neither to kind of pave my way. Yeah. Right. We had to pave our way into where we're at today. And Absolutely. We made success out of it. And I think that's really the root of immigrants. I think really that's really where you see, the power that we behold within. And as long as we believe, as long as we educate ourselves to be competitive, that's really where we're able to set the tone. And I think with what I desire in my professional career is to be a man of service. I think I've chosen the right career path. Absolutely. I love what I do. I don't feel that I'm working. I feel like every single day is a blessing for me to be able to, share what I know. But with that being said, I do believe in giving back and spending time in the community and being somebody of service and a mentor. Really me being able to be in a position in my career that complements what I do as a philanthropist, those two together are my calling today. So
I love that. And just you, by you sharing your story here today with me, I think you are, you're holding true to that, because what we need more of is to see, right? You can't be what you can't see, right? And we need to hear these stories, and we need to see the people that, look like us, that came from neighborhoods like us in Queens, that that don't look like us, and maybe they're not, Haitian or Latina, maybe they're from Afghanistan, maybe they're from India, maybe they're from, other parts of the world, but, that have not had a blueprint of life given to them that really paved the way. So just by you telling your story to audiences and to children and to other emerging professionals, you are holding true to being a mentor and helping communities, because there's power in storytelling. Like, there's power in sharing that you got a second chance at life, that you're a walking, talking miracle, that, you parents grew up in Queens and then went to Miami and then went to Haiti, then came back to Miami, and then you went to the NFL, and then you got hurt in the, it's an important story, and it's a true testament of adversity. So you're holding true to that by sharing your story.
Absolutely. And it's just a compliment to be able to share it and really touch lives. I think if we're able to change one life, we're doing so much positive in the world with greater good. Absolutely. It takes one child, just one child. If they can, ask that question, be in a position to where they can think a little differently and not just follow a system, now we're creating generational wealth.
Absolutely. I think, for you being a first gen, for me being a first generation, have you ever felt moments where you were just like, you like walked into a meeting, walked into a boardroom, a conference room, whatever, and you were just like, damn, no one looks like me in this room. And did that ever like creep in on you?
Every single time I walk into a boardroom, or every time I walk into a meeting, there's nobody looks like me. And I'm so proud at, you know, the accomplishments and the merits that I can hold today with humility, because I know that I had to work harder. I had to study longer. I had to make sure that I understood that formula for me to be able to articulate that concept to people. And obviously, when I realized that not many people look like me when I'm sitting at a round table and describing something, but if I understand something, it's not about, you know, really competing with others in that way. It's about, well, how do you help lift somebody up? And maybe if they don't understand something, you allow them to take their time, but you share it a different way, because everybody looks at it differently. Somebody can think, you know, 6 and 3 equals 9, and somebody can think, you know, obviously 7 and 2 equal 9 as well, and that's the only way they can see it. So essentially, it's like everybody has a different persona. Everybody mm-hmm. sees something in a different perspective, but it's all about having the patience to appreciate growth. And that's what I have learned sitting in boardrooms, that you should never approach somebody and belittle them because they don't understand, or they just haven't captured the information like you have. You should actually take an inspiration that, because obviously they have an intelligence in a different space. And that intelligence can complement you as well and make you both better.
Absolutely.
So I would open my arms, and I'm very happy to sometimes not say a word and just listen. Because listening, now you're learning something. If you keep talking, that means you're just regurgitating what you already know.
And you're not listening.
Right. And you can obviously learn something from somebody every day.
Absolutely. Yeah. And just appreciating that diversity of thought, of like not having all the people in the one room thinking the same, looking the same, but just having, you know, different folks with different ideas and different points of view is a really, really, I mean, there's data out there and research on this. Like, you want to launch the best products, you better have a room full of people that like reflect the globe and all think differently, because mm-hmm. everyone will think of a different problem to that product. Everyone will think of a different solution. So the more diverse thoughts you have, like the more you have a chance of a successful product, or, you know, what have you. Yeah, imposter syndrome is real. And I, you know, before we were getting on this episode, I stumbled on this quote, and I was like, I have to read this out loud because it's so good. And it said, it speaks to when you don't feel that you belong, and you're just like, you know, you're starting to really like question yourself. And it says, all I try to do is just root my feet and feel like I have a right, my feet, wait, let me read this again. All I try to do is just root my feet and feel like I have a right to be here. I deserve to be loved. I deserve to be seen. I am seen. I am loved. I think that's so powerful. Wow. That just feeling that you have, everyone has a place here, right? Everyone Absolutely. has an opinion, has a thought, and it's beautiful to appreciate that diversity of thought.
That's amazing. That's a beautiful thing that you shared. It's just living in the present time. I got a lot from that just by understanding the words. And you never know, again, like, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow. But if you cherish the moments now, that might be the best time and the best experience you can ever have.
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to leave a little time for us to talk about the situation in Haiti. I know that, you know, you grew up there. You have ties there. You spent years there. And it's really hard to see. I'm sure you remember this, but when that devastating earthquake hit Haiti, I think it was like over a decade ago, or maybe like 10 years. And then
2010.
Right. And then flash forward, happens again, right? Another, you know, catastrophic natural disaster happens again. You have the leader of the country that's shot dead. You have a really, really tough situation with refugees and Haitian refugees, to be specific, trying to leave the country because it's not livable. It's not, you can't survive there. So I just want to like talk about a little bit of how it has been for you to see the images of, and I feel like everyone will know what I'm talking about at this point. And if you don't, you can just Google Haitian refugees at the border and the images will pop up, but they are really, really heartbreaking. Really, I don't understand how this is happening in this time, given what happened post George Floyd and all of, you know, the protests, peaceful protests, trying to spotlight racial inequity, racial inequality, and like people taking to the streets protesting, to see these photos of these border patrols on horses with whips, whipping Haitian refugees. Like, how did that sit with you?
It's disgusting. It's something that's unbearable, that no human should be dehumanized in that way. We're not there in the Jim Crow days. And I think, obviously, when you think about the way that these men are trained, it starts in the system. And if Haitians were in the position where they were in 1804, when they declared their independence against France and took back, you know, what belonged to them and became the first Black Republic, we would be on the news for a whole different story. But when you have people who are harmless, people who just want an opportunity to give to their children, very similar to how my mom wanted to give to us, it's disgraceful. It's a bad taste to have to really think about seeing those images, because the world is a very bad place. And when we think about, well, how do we help the situation that we're seeing right now? Nobody has answers, but everybody has an opinion. And I think, obviously, when you think about what you see right now, those men should be in a position to where they're not able to wear a badge anymore, and they're not able to have that type of power anymore because it's abuse. And I feel that if we were able to allow immigrants who built the United States of America,
that's right,
on their backbone, we are able to at least make a way for people who want to go into asylum, because their country is not in the best position for them to be able to have the things that us Americans have. And you can't blame those people, because obviously they spent 3 months trailing from country to country to give their families, their children, a hope. When you think about, as a Haitian American, somebody who's in the position that I'm in, I'm going to speak my voice. I'm going to let it be known that it's not fair. I'm going to say that it's something that needs to be repaired from the system. And when you think about, you know, the situation, Haiti can't catch a break. Last quarter, the assailant that, you know, or the many assailants who went into the country and assassinated our president, that's still going under investigation. For us to face an earthquake, now we have actual gangs who are running the country. So when you think about the corruption and the overall situation at large, Haiti is a beautiful country. When you think about the aid that it can receive from the richest country in the world, where are we at?
Right.
And that's where you think about the United States in a different aspect, our government. Because when you think about it, Haiti was a country that provided resources to the United States many, many years ago, where it was funding, it was resources, it was commodities. There are so many things that come from that country, but it's always been strong-armed. And the people have always been the people who suffer. When you think about what you see today, we must speak about this. We must demand change. We must protest, because that's the only way we're going to be heard.
Yeah.
Being one of the countries, you know, in the world that has the lowest income, you know, one of the countries that, when you think about, people are surviving off of their, you know, gourd currency, which if you convert that to dollars, is not much. But essentially, people are still able to provide their children with food, able to at least, you know, have enough resources to buy petroleum to, you know, light their burners to make a hot plate. But people are living there in poverty because the system. Why are the people take so much from that country and not figure out a way to help that economy? There's ways to do it because we figured it out in the U.S. And there's other islands around that Western Caribbean that are in a position to grow and still facilitate an economy that's livable. Right. My parents live there. But when you think about going back to our conversation on their roots, you know, what they know from their perspective, you're always going to have that sensible, you know, place in your heart for your country. At the same time, when you see things that are going on today with our own Americans, it's disgraceful for us to be witnesses of what we're seeing right now at the border.
Yeah, I mean, for me, watching that was definitely like looking at textbook what was going on, like you said, during Jim Crow. Like, it was unbelievable to me to see that in 2021. Just the imagery, like whoever was in charge that day, who's in charge now, who's been in charge for a while, like just the imagery of that, it's so barbaric. And it's so, I mean, it has slavery written all over it, it has racism written all over it. Like, it's just not the way to do it, right? Like, if you're going to be border patrolling, like probably on a horse with a whip, not the way to do it. Not right. The way. So I think the imagery is definitely what just really stung probably you, stung me. For me, like that border has been notorious for people crossing over from Central America. And we just went through, you know, a couple of years ago with the kids in the cages, and, you know, it's still, that's still a situation. So it hits home. So like the way that I saw that, like children were separated from their mom or from their dad, and they probably could have been from Honduras. That's, you're seeing also like your people from Haiti at the border being whipped with white men that are on horses. Like, it is just unconscionable.
Mm-hmm. Unconstitutional if you think about it. But it's time for that island to be able to be in a position where we at least have the aid. And if it's not from the United States, it should be from other foreign countries who are able to assist. And we have had some support. There have been other nations that have sent tons and tons of resources over to the island. But it's, you know, now when it arrives in the islands, well, how are we going to distribute these resources to the people? Because now we have anarchy. That's running the overall country because of our constitution there that needs to be repaired. Yeah. There's a lot of work to be done, but we can't give up, and we won't give up.
Yeah. And I also want to like bring home the point of what you just mentioned before, that Haiti was the first,
Black Republic.
That's right. Was the first Black Republic in the Western Hemisphere, right? Correct. So like
in 1804, they claimed independence.
Yeah. That is, I mean, talk about people that are going to fight and hustle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right?
Absolutely.
First Black Republic. So let's leave it on that happy note of celebrating that part of Haiti, right? But we do know that there are injustices, and we definitely want to amplify that. And I know you as a Haitian American, you definitely want people to know what's going on there. Read up on Haiti, you know, Google those photos we're talking about, because they are disgusting, but they should be seen. But I want to transition as we start to conclude the episode. What would you tell my beautiful Christopher to 16-year-old Christopher?
Christopher at 34, talking to Christopher at 16. I would say stay focused and take a path and write down your thoughts and really think about what inspires you. Because what you think about that inspires you is really what's going to allow you to trace your journey ahead. And it starts with, you know, focus and discipline. But as long as you can see it, you can dream it, you can achieve it. And that's what I would tell Christopher at 16, is to never give up. There will be adversity. There will be times that you have to learn how to overcome, but never quit, because that's not in our bloodline. And keep on moving. Never stop. Just keep on moving, because if you stop, you die. But if you keep on moving, there will be fruition.
I love that. Movement is life, right? I love that. Okay, so how do people find out about your amazing work, what you're doing? Do you have any socials you want to share, any website or anything that we can find out all about Christopher Dora?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. And thank you so much for just, you know, asking me. You are able to follow me on Instagram, Zoe, Z-O-E underscore the T-H-E underscore legend. That's my handle on Instagram. On my professional side, you can follow me at Chris Dora Finance, K-R-I-S D-O-U-R-A Finance. I'm also on Facebook Business as well. I tend to put out a lot of great, you know, information that's very helpful for people. You can also follow me on YouTube, Chris Dora Planner. And overall, just, you know, connect with me. I'm very open. I'm very human. And I can talk to about any types of person. And I think, you know, just being able to connect, you know, and be a resource. And I'm very, very happy that we had the opportunity to connect. And I got to, you know, have an opportunity to come on the podcast. I think you're doing an amazing job. I fully support you. And I can't wait for you to reach even higher heights.
Thank you.
Continue following you. You guys follow Vanessa, First Gen Collective. It's an amazing, amazing show. She's an amazing host. And there's so much more to come. I'm thrilled and can't wait to see.
Thank you. Thank you. I mean, again, I the way I started the episode was I said this has come full circle for me to interview someone that is like, you know, you are a brother from another mother for sure. And because Nino was my second mother growing up. And to have this episode is really special to me because you knew me when I was like 7-year-old Vanessa, 8-year-old Vanessa, 9-year-old Vanessa, like this like little skinny girl in Queens, like with my big curly hair, huge curly hair. And you know, like just like happy little kids running around Queens, New York, just having a good old time. I'm learning Creole, eating all your mom's delicious Haitian food that I still dream about. Like all I want is your mom to cook me a delicious Haitian meal. It's so delicious. Anyone go to a Haitian restaurant, seriously, and get yourself some Haitian food. It is delicious. But seriously, full circle. I love you. I love you. I adore you. You are like my brother. You are amazing. I'm so proud of you as like, you know, your quote unquote bigger sister. I'm so proud to see all the things you've done, all the adversity you've been through. Like now you're a testament sharing your story. So it's been an honor to have you on the First Gen Collective.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
All right. Bye, brother.
See you, sis.